15 or 18, I guess, of these yellow books. If anybody still wants them.
Mendel's law, not
a theory. Now this, I don't need to tell you, was exceedingly disappointing to the evolutionists that they were not able to convert one species into another, although they did get a large number of varieties. So the net result of the whole business was that if you define a species, and it is not easy to define a species, but if you do define a species as an interbreeding community, that is where the members thereof are fertile inter se, then no new species has ever been formed. This is rather damaging to the theory of evolution in the mind of a lot of people. No new species has ever been formed. That's number one. Got that? Now, even if they had been able to convert a fruit fly into a bumblebee under very, very carefully controlled conditions over a long span of generations, I still wouldn't be convinced that it happened in the past by chance. But the fact that they were not able, and have not been able, through countless years of, not countless years, but many decades of trying to convert one species into another, is exceedingly damaging to the theory of evolution. So if you define a species as an interbreeding community, no new species have ever been formed. Yes?
New species of animals.
Species of animals?
Have been mutated into brand new species.
Well, I don't want to argue with you, but I believe this is a fact, that if you define a species as an interbreeding community, then no new species have been formed.
How about the short-legged sheep? Are you familiar with which was a mutation and was interbred with other sheep and purified until now they have raised a superior sheep for man's use?
Yeah, this is my next point. You got that? That's number one. Number two is that mutations are not random. Darwin believed that animals and plants vary in every direction, all over the lot. And that natural selection worked on these variations, which vary in every direction all over the lot, and gradually the thing climbed up the ladder. But Mendel's law says that mutations vary in a fixed mathematical way. Now what has been found is that nearly all species are plastic. Some more, some less. And you can get, as they got here, around 400 varieties. And they can with sheep or with most other animals and plants. Get like strawberries. You can get a vast number of varieties of strawberries or apples or so forth. So you can get a fairly large plasticity within the interbreeding community. So that is what evolution demands. It demands a forward movement in the thing so that you get a new species. Now, let me give you an example of what it is. It's rather not an exact example, but it's not far from how it works. You've all either seen or seen pictures of a guy on a tightrope. He's got a long pole, and he's going along this tightrope, which is strung out like this, and he can, with this long pole, he can bend a long way from each side as he stands there on this tightrope. This is like plasticity of a species. You can bend a long way up and down. But what evolution demands is that the guy take one step forward, which is an entirely different thing from standing still on a thing and bending in many directions up and down. Now, species do have a long plasticity on either side, although they can't always toward the norm in the middle. But evolution demands that the thing go forward, and an entirely new species of a more complex nature be formed. And this, experimentally, has never been accomplished, although they have been trying for many decades. Now, I saw hands flashing in the air. That's Sam.
You mean by Mendel's law, what you put on the screen a few minutes ago, with the pink dots and so forth, the really green, that doesn't have anything to do with mutations, because mutations are actual physical changes in a gene as it passes through reproduction from one generation to another, whereas Mendel's law only governs the arrangement of genes as they pass unchanged from one generation to another. Mendel himself didn't know anything about mutations because he lived before they were discovered, but mutations do occur.
Yeah, that's right. Mutations do occur. There is a certain, there is, as I say, a vast range of plasticity within each species. These are called mutations. You can get short-legged sheep or long-legged sheep. You can get strawberries that are quite large and some that are quite small. Some early bearing and some late bearing. But what evolution demands is that you step forward into a more complex animal or plant. And this has not been accomplished, even though there is a great amount of plasticity within these species. For instance, dogs are an interbreeding community, all right, and they have developed over the years many different varieties of dogs. From a little wee tiny chihuahua that you hold in your hand like this to a great big St. Bernard like that. They are interbreeding. They are an interbreeding community and so on. But you don't keep on, there's limits to the plasticity of these species. You don't go down to the Toronto Exhibition or Expo and go into a building and say, here is this year's species of dog that we've developed. I mean, they just about reached the end of the plasticity. They may get some slight variations from now on, but they aren't continuously getting new dogs. And some animals, you can't even do as well as you can with dogs. For instance, geese are very narrow in their limits. Dogs are wider, cats are wider, and so on. Some species are wider in their plasticity than others. But the theory of evolution demands that you move forward into a more complex animal from what they call simple into more complex, which is a different proposition altogether from moving sideways within the interbreeding community. Now, I think with respect to experiment, which has been carried on, we can say this, that first of all, in the field of experiment to prove the theory of evolution, there's been one failure so far, and that is that they have failed to produce life, which is alleged to have been produced by the faculties of pure chance and natural forces in the past. This they have failed to do. They're still working on it. We'll see. Number two, they have failed, as far as I've been able to read, I've never heard anybody claim yet that they have been able to produce a new species, if you define species as an interbreeding community. New varieties? Terrific. Lots of them. New species? No. These two facts, where they have failed in their experiments to show how the theory of evolution works, is, in my view, a very damaging thing to the theory of evolution. I now want to turn to the subject of the fossil record. This is hailed in textbooks and in college and high school classes as a tremendous evidence of the theory of evolution. Whereas, I think if you look into it closely, you will see that it is the exact opposite. It is virtually fatal to the theory of evolution. I now wish to cover two points in that direction. There are many theories of how fossils are formed, and I am not an expert in geology. I have no degree in geology. I have no degree in biology. I am trying to apply common, ordinary horse sense to this problem. But the surface of the Earth was alleged to have been like this at one time, and a great earthquake and buckling of the Earth's surface as it cooled off and as great cataclysmic changes were made in the surface of the Earth occurred, and there arose vast mountain ranges like that, where the crust of the earth had buckled up. Then the forces of wind, ice, snow, rain, earthquake, and so on began to work on these higher peaks, and layers were washed down and formed like this. So that the earliest layer would be formed, we'll number them. Number one, do you want to get a note of this? This is a simple sketch of what they think happened. This would be the earliest, number one. Number two would be somewhat later. Number three would be still later. Number four, number five would be still later. Meanwhile, of course, this mountain range has much decreased in size as the erosion has taken place. So these layers are found on the surface of the earth. And these layers are likened by some writers to an onion skin. You know how you take an onion and you peel off layer after layer of the skin of the onions until you get down to a little wee tiny fellow in the center. So these layers that are alleged to have enveloped the surface of the earth are likened to an onion skin, and sometimes it is called the onion skin theory. Now, as these layers were allegedly laid down, fossils, or the petrified form of animals and plants, were formed in them. It doesn't take very long to form a fossil. There is a spring near Doon, Ontario, which if you put an apple in it, in a rather short time, will become quite an interesting fossil. It will be petrified. The ruins of Pompeii in Italy, which were put under volcanic ash in 1870, contain many fossils of the animals and plants, men, which were there at the time. So you don't have to go back 6 zillion years to find fossils. You can find them fairly recently. Now, supposing you have a series of layers like this, you go out in Tennessee or someplace where you live and on a side of a cliff, you see these layers. Should you find, if the theory of evolution be true, the so-called simple forms at the top of this thing or at the bottom? Everybody sure about that? You find them at the bottom?
You find them all the way through.
Well, according to the theory of evolution, however, you should find the simple down here. And then as you go up from 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, you should find them in increasing complexity. In other words, the simple form should be at the earliest layer down near the bottom of the onion, or the core of the onion. And as you go up, you should find them in increasing complexity. I think this is a fairly simple way in which the theory is alleged to work. So, what they did then is give names to these various layers. And the first fossil-bearing layer that they found, they called the Cambrian. And then they started giving names all the way up. Then they started to date how old the layers were. And if you get almost any textbook on geology, you will find what's known as a geological timetable. I should have had this reproduced on a slide, but I forgot to get it done. But the next layer, I'll read them for you, is Ordovician, and then above that is Silurian, next above Devonian, Mississippian, Pennsylvanian, Permian, Triassic, Jurassic, Cretaceous, Paleocene, Eocene, so on up the line, right up to the top. All these names. Then on the side of the next column of the table is what happened allegedly, in the various layers. So in the Cambrian, we have all subkingdoms of invertebrate animals represented. Trilobites, so on. In the Ordovician, the next one up, earliest known vertebrates. Graptolites, turtles, brachiopods, and so on. Next one up is Silurian, earliest known land animals, primitive land plants, rise of fishes, so on. And the first one, by the way, was from 200 million to 500 million years ago. Then we come down to fairly modern times. Let's look at another one. In the Triassic, earliest dinosaurs, flying reptiles, marine animals, and primitive mammals. In the Cretaceous, modernized angiosperms and insects abundant. Extinction of dinosaurs, flying reptiles, and ammonites, and so forth. So, you get down to the rise of modern plants and man between 975,000 years ago and 25,000 years ago. However, remember I said that the Cambrian was the first fossil-bearing layer, which was, it is believed, around, although textbooks are not agreed, I'm going to read this textbook. If you've got one that contradicts it, don't blame me. I'm just reading a guy who wrote. I wasn't there 500 million years ago, and I don't think the author was either, so I don't know how long it is, so you get a variation. However, while this is the first fossil-bearing layer, and it's called the Cambrian, below that, going back, some go as far back as 4 billion years ago, and others stop it at 1.8 billion years ago, and I don't know which is right. But below this, there are other layers as well. Now, when you write this down, I think virtually all of the geologists who write on evolution believe that, I'll get another color of pencil here so you can see what I'm talking about. I believe all of them are agreed that 3/4 of evolution, starting with the first cell down here, took place below the Cambrian and only 1/4 above. So that if the whole business is 2 billion years, then this period would be 1.5 billion years old from here at the start up to here, and this would be 0.5 billion years from there up to man, which is at the top. Now, everybody got that? All right. Now, there is a serious defect available to people who want to look at it in this program. And the defect is that below this red line, during which 3/4 of evolution is alleged to have taken place, there are no fossils available. That all geologists admit are fossils. Somebody comes up with some little thing he thinks is a fossil. But there's no agreement by any means that there are any fossils available from here to here, although 3/4 of evolution took place, and although these layers are eminently suitable for the bearing of fossils. So for 3/4 of evolution, there is no historical evidence of it. Yes?
3/4 of evolution took place among animals which are either one cell or aggregates of one cell, which don't have any bones, and boneless animals find it difficult to leave themselves for posterity as fossils. So obviously there can't be any fossils in that 3/4 of the time, but that doesn't prove that there weren't simple animals living.
All right, we'll answer that now. You're admitting that there are no fossils down here, right?
Well, there have been some found, but then all of this isn't quite perfect. So, right, there's an obvious difference. There's an obvious point at which a lot of fossils begin to appear.
Well, I think most geologists then admit that from this point below, there are no fossils. Now, of course, they have come up with explanations because creationists have asked them why it is. If three-quarters of evolution took place in this period, there are no fossils. And they have to come up with explanations. Whether they're good or not remains for you to decide. But this is a fact, as Sam has said, that for some reason or another, there are no fossils, or exceedingly few, if any. Well now, I want to just put a couple of things on the screen now with respect to this matter. By the way, here is a slide of the classifications of the animal kingdom. This is in reverse order to what I just had them on the board. I started at the bottom and went up to the top. This is starting at the top and going down to the bottom. So they give names to these various animals. This is protozoa, single-celled animals, sea mats, jellyfish, so on, right down here to the vertebrata, which are backbone animals, which is what we are. So there is the classification that some biologists at least accept to classify the animals which they find in the world. I want to put up now a quotation from the high priest of evolution, and I guess in the world, really, certainly in North America, George Gaylord Simpson. He is the most prolific writer on evolution, is recognized as a world authority, and of course is in Harvard University. And he says, the processes of organic history usually act exceedingly slowly. It is more the rule than the exception for a really appreciable change in a given lineage to take a million years or more. Remember this quotation because this is very important, I think, that these appreciable changes take a million years or more. That's a fairly long time, a very gradual program. Well, you have a chance, if you're a fast writer, you might write that down, because I want to refer to this more tomorrow when we come to another seriously damaging part of the thing that, in my view, nullifies the doctrine of evolution. This is what James, and I think no one of George's colleagues would question his authority on this point. Well, here is, again, what is the actual fact of the case. Here is a diagram of layers of rock, and the first one here, as you can see, is the Cambrian. They've got a little touch of the Silurian and Ordovician here are missing. They come out a little touch of Devonian, and then they come to Carboniferous. Now in the Cambrian, which is the first fossil-bearing layer, there are many fossils. In fact, when you write this down, in the Cambrian layer, this is the first fossil-bearing layer, all of those classifications, which I just put on the screen, are found except the vertebrates. All are found except the vertebrates. Immediately below, none that are universally agreed are fossils are found. This is very damaging to the theory of evolution. And although explanations have been offered, it is still damaging. Otherwise, why would they be still searching in the Precambrian layers for fossils and trying to identify some as fossils if it wasn't important to their theory? So here we have many fossils in the Cambrian, and no fossils at all, although the layers are eminently suitable for burying the fossils, immediately below. But that isn't all. In the Cambrian layer, which is the first fossil-bearing layer, everything appears except the vertebrates, and write this down, will you? Fully formed, perfectly formed, and abruptly. In other words, the first time anything appears at all is perfectly formed, a perfectly functioning animal or plant, and it appears abruptly. Immediately below, none. except the vertebrates. Here's Dr. Simpson again. He says, Precambrian fossils are, however, widely scattered in place and time, and do not constitute a continuous or as yet even a particularly enlightening record. Equally scattered, but rather numerous animals have been reported from the Precambrian, but all are in serious doubt. Serious doubt. Now this is something for Dr. Simpson to admit when he is the high priest of evolution. Now look at what this eminent evolutionist says. With the beginning of the Cambrian, unquestionable, abundant, and quite varied fossil animals appear. And he could have used there abruptly. The change is, well he does, the change is great and abrupt. This is not only the most puzzling feature of the whole fossil record, but also its greatest apparent inadequacy. This is Dr. George Gaylord Simpson making this confession. The change is great and abrupt, he says. He says it's the most puzzling feature of the whole fossil record. Now, like Darwin, who thought he explained something by admitting it, George Gaylord Simpson is here admitting a very serious flaw in the theory of evolution. But this, my friends, does by no means explain it. Just because he admits it doesn't explain it. Right? I want you to pay particular attention to this admission by Simpson. Now let me show you. Now here, you don't have to be a genius, I don't think, to recognize, I'll get another one first. This little creature is called a tribellate, and it is abundant in the Cambrian layer. In fact, it's so abundant that geologists refer to them as rock bugs. It's about the size of a bed bug, which I know none of you have ever seen or had any experience with. I have, however, and they look something like a very, very miniature turtle. Now let me ask you this. This rock bug, or trilobite, is abundant in the Cambrian. Would you say it's complex or simple? It has an antenna here. It's got multiple eyes here. It's got very, very complicated scale and back structure, as you can see here, perhaps not too clearly, but nevertheless, you can see. And of course, feet and so forth. Multiple eyes, rather interesting antenna here, and so on. Would you call this simple or complex? Yeah, I would say that multiple eyes were reasonably hard to make. You'll want to try it sometime, try and make a pair. These appear abruptly, as Simpson says, in the Cambrian, in the very first fossil-bearing layer. Here's another picture of them. Perhaps, well, it's not too bad. These are from the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. So you can see that they are very highly complex animals and appear in great abundance. Now, these appear abruptly in the Cambrian. Immediately below, I'm not asking for a whole abundance, but let's have a couple of half-formed of these trilobites. Maybe the parts aren't quite as hard as these are. Maybe they don't fossilize quite as well. But surely to goodness, if evolution has had three-quarters of its term to operate up to that point, we should be able to find some. And the explanation given that they're all soft parts doesn't really wash, because immediately below there should be some evidence of creatures, something like this, only not as complex. And as Simpson admits, there are none that all admit are such. Here's Simpson again talking. Among available fossils, not a single one, not even the most exceptional, represents a really complete individual with all its tissues and organs, just as they were at the moment of death. Now, when you go into the Smithsonian Institute, the Royal Ontario Museum, or the Chicago Museum of Natural History, and look at a cage with way down at one end is a little wee animal, and then they keep going up the line, so about the middle, you get a guy standing there like this, with a club, and then a little farther along, you get him a little more erect with a little finer club, and then a little, you know, right up to man. You can conclude this from that, that the guys who are proficient in making plaster of Paris models are wonderful. But it really has nothing to do with the theory of evolution, except that they are very proficient in making models. And Dr. Arthur Tussens, by the way, in one of his doorway papers, I forget which number it is, I have it, has a whole paper on this point, which he calls the fraud of reconstructing whole beings from a fragment of a tooth or something like this, frauds which have been perpetrated on the public in the past. It is a guess that on the order of 1 to 10% of all species that ever lived are recoverable as fossils, and that of these, on the order of 1 to 10% have so far been found and described. These estimates of the great incompleteness of the currently known record may give much too gloomy an impression of the usefulness of that record and of its adequacy for the solving the problems of evolution. Now, from what George Gaylord Simpson says here, would you say that the record is complete or incomplete? The fossil record.
Incomplete.
Would you say it's complete or incomplete? Because on this hangs a tale. You see, evolutionists adopt a heads I win, tails you lose type of coin flipping. In other words, they adopt a position which effectively springs themselves against defeat. And if you look carefully at their works, you will find that much of their reasoning is done in what's known in logic as circular reasoning. Now let me put a kind of circular reasoning on the board here. You might write this down, it's not very long. But this isn't a joke. This is much more prevalent in evolutionary works than you would guess would be the case of people who are supposed to be writing from a scientific point of view. There is a big dispute going on as to whether the geological record is complete or incomplete. Now, evolutionists like to have it both ways. When they're arguing out of this side of their mouth, they like to say the record is complete. For instance, when they set down the pedigree of the horse, they say the record is complete. We found the pedigree of the horse. We have a little horse about the size of a Chihuahua dog, and then it goes right up to one the size of a fox, and right up the line, so it's right up to the present-day horse. The record is complete. We've got it solved. Here is a case in the pedigree of the horse where evolution is absolutely proved. So you say, yeah, guess you're right. Yeah, looks pretty good, because you can go to the Smithsonian Institute and go to another one of these cages now, and they'll have a big neon sign up, the pedigree of the horse. And you'll see this progression right up, just as I have tried to describe it. But when you ask them other questions, and try and pin these people down, it's something like trying to grab a hold of a slippery pig in a barnyard. It's very difficult to pin them down because they operate on a set of rules which insulates them against defeat. And this is the kind of reasoning they use. This, as I say, is not a joke, but in many of their works, circular reasoning is used. In other words, the theory of evolution is proved by the theory. They use the theory to prove the theory. Darwin was a master at this, using the theory to prove the theory. Now, if you ask them, why is the geological record imperfect? How do you know it's imperfect? You say it's imperfect. He said so right here. Didn't he? He says, the great incompleteness of the currently known record It's only 10% of 10%. So he says it's incomplete. So you say to him, Dr. Simpson, how do you know the record is incomplete? And he says, because we continue to miss the missing links. So you say, well, why are the missing links missing? And he says, because the geological record is incomplete. And this happens, and I can cite you many cases where this kind of circular reasoning, where the theory itself is used to prove the theory, is used. Now, getting back to, what time have we got? Getting back to the geological record again, the fact that there are no agreed pre-Cambrian fossils. As you can see from what I put on the board here, the evolutionists themselves admit is a difficulty and a flaw in the theory of evolution. You can give explanations of it all you like, but it's still a serious difficulty in the theory of evolution that three-quarters of evolution has no historical evidence whatsoever to support it. The next thing is that all the way up the record, not only in the Cambrian, but all the way up these layers, every animal appears abruptly. The first time a turtle is found, it is found completely formed as a turtle. Now, on that point, we want to speak more particularly. We've covered one difficulty, that is the lack of Precambrian fossils, but now we come to a difficulty of the theory of evolution, which in my view is utterly fatal to the theory. And this can be, this is number four now, this is a test of lack of intermediate fossils. The test of the lack of intermediate fossils. Here are layers of rock. The oldest animal should be at the bottom. The newest animal should be at the top. And in the middle, there should be gradual gradations thereof. There are no cases of half-formed animals that have ever been discovered. They all, in the first time of the appearance of an animal, be it a bat, a spider, a turtle, or whatever, it appears a perfectly formed, and it appears suddenly. This, my friends, is fatal to the theory of evolution. There are no half-formed animals ever been found. Now, is the record complete or is it incomplete? You can't have it both ways, remember. So on one side of their mouth, they rely on the incompleteness of the record to explain this, however. But the incompleteness of the record is not going to do anymore. Was all right in Darwin's day because he said, and frankly confessed, that if these intermediate forms were not found, his theory would crash to the ground. So there's been a 120-year search since Darwin and before since Lyell to find the intermediate forms and the so-called missing links. So there hasn't been any lack of trying. So now we have this position where, you can write this down to 60.5%. Of land animals now living, I'll put down now for now living, have been found as fossils. .6% of marine animals now living have been found as fossils. And 74.5% of mollusks have been found as fossils. So there's been a pretty good combing over of the geological record to find the missing links or these intermediate forms. Now the fact of the matter is that no intermediate forms have been found. Now if the theory of evolution is true, we should have a very different picture from this presented to us. If you have a layer, layers of rock here, and in this layer, say you find for the first time a turtle. Immediately below that, you should find a turtle. I'm going to say half-formed, but that's only a figure. It could be 70% or 90% or some percentage. But let's say a half-formed turtle immediately below. And below that, maybe you should find a quarter-formed turtle. But the fact of the matter is that whenever these things are found, they are always found, fully formed, and abruptly. But the theory says that if you find any animal at any point in the geological strata, immediately above, it should be slightly more complex than it is there. And immediately below, it should be slightly less complex than it is at the point where you're finding it. But this has not proven to be the case, a fact which, in my view, is fatal to the theory of evolution. Darwin recognized this in many places in his books, and he said that all he wanted was more time. The reason he said we haven't found the half-formed fellow is because we haven't looked hard enough. I've just started on this thing. But he confidently predicted that the half-formed animals, or the animals in a state of coming into something, would undoubtedly be found. They were called the missing links. However, 120 years has elapsed, and they haven't found any yet, although they have found that table that I have told you. They've got a fairly complete picture of the fossil record, and they still have not found any intermediate fossils. I don't know how you think about that, but if I were trying to uphold a theory of the gradual ascent from simple to complex forms, and I was relying on the fossil record to do it, and I couldn't find any of them, I would be upset. And some of them are too. Another point is that the transitional creatures, that is the half-formed creatures, should be far more numerous than the fully formed creatures. If evolution is true, it took a long, and as we read here from George Gaylord Simpson, it takes a million years for any perceptible, let's get that again. I want to make a particular point of that. Here's what Simpson says. Let's just read it again, because this is very germane to this absence of intermediate creatures. The processes of organic history usually act exceedingly slowly. It is more the rule than the exception for a really appreciable change in a given lineage to take a million years or more. Fine. If we can find a fully formed turtle, which is a highly complex and easily identifiable animal, and it took a million years, my friends, for a perceptible change, appreciable change to take place, then below the fully formed turtle, there should be layers and layers and layers of turtles coming into turtledom. And there ain't any. They never found one. Now, this is absolutely ridiculous. For grown men to build a whole theory on the fossil record, and they can't even find one single case of a half-formed creature. Never mind of a turtle, of a spider, of anything you want to name. They just can't find any. This is utterly fatal, as Darwin admitted. All he wanted was more time. Well, time we've now had, and we still haven't been able to solve this very damaging problem. Because if it takes a million years for an appreciable change to take place, below the fully formed turtle, to being a turtle. But we have none. This, as far as the fossil record is concerned, in my view, I don't care what you think, in my view, it's utterly fatal to the theory of